bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
Yo.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
Splashdown. Do you feel it? Do you feel it, everybody?
Yeah, you know what? I feel it because I feel my jealousy of not having a boat to be one of the gawkers that made a beeline to just sit there and watch all of it unfold. How he was the Coachella of space missions. It was unreal.
Don't know or listen to this in the far future.
Oh, Bryce doesn't know about this.
I missed all this.
So about 63 days ago or so, NASA and SpaceX sent the Crew Dragon capsule up to the International Space Station with Bob and Doug, you know, not the Canadian duo, the American astronaut duo, sent them to the National Space Station. And then yesterday, they splashed down. They returned from their mission to the International Space Station off the coast of Pensacola, middle of the ocean, but not that far in the middle of the ocean. There to greet them was NASA crews, SpaceX crews, the Coast Guard, and a lot of people in boats because it's Florida.
There's a reason they call that the Redneck Riviera. I mean, it's it was the official NASA.
That's response. A lot of boats.
I know.
That's not all rescue boats. That's a lot of fools out there.
Dudes on jet skis. NASA's official response included the phrase, "We need to do better."
Well, and So here's the thing. The part of the reason is the danger is that one of the things, the fuels they use on board, this, these what are called hypergolics. Remember when they tested the last one on the stand and it blew up? Like very, very, you know, that's this hypergolic. It's a super, very incredibly powerful fuel. It takes, you know, just it ignites super fast. It's one of the things you use for the escape rockets, etc. So when the thing lands, that's the thing you're worried about. It's also the fumes are extremely toxic. One of the worst on-the-ground disasters ever was like a Soviet rocket killed like 70 people when like the upper stages blew up, not counting the hundreds of others that got it. You know, the fumes and stuff affected them. They say they were in a safe margin, but it's one of these things you don't want a bunch of big power boats and stuff and people driving around. And this is just...
These pictures, it's just, I have long said that the state motto for Florida in my heart is sorry for party rocking, and nothing typifies it more than just like this momentous occasion in quite possibly a first step of space colonization in a way that we have never seen before. And it's just like randos with like, you know, Bud Light coolers. Just
Bud Light seltzer.
Yes!
I joked, and I'm sure I heard it somewhere else, is like, you know, the crew should have like the ground crew should have been wearing like 8 masks when they opened up the door to greet them. This is a pretty close second.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. It's just you know, the only thing that would have made it more Florida is if they would have tossed both Bob and Doug each their own beers to shotgun as their first acts, having repatriated to Earth.
Oh, I just imagine. I just imagine smash cut to the NASA meeting, and in the background, whatever they're saying in the background, you just see a circle around Florida with the word "no" in red. or either that, or they make the announcement tomorrow that they're going to go straight to vertical landings with the capsule on land.
Although I do love that it's that image, Brian, that made you turn into the cat meme with the newspaper of like, I should buy a boat. You know, that's what made it's like, I never really saw the worth in a boat until I watched a bunch of ding dongs ringing the splashdown of a private dragon space flight.
Somebody had a MAGA flag.
Yeah. Trump Pence flag, yeah.
Yeah, that's hilarious. All right, sorry, I cut you off, Andrew.
Oh, yeah, well, so If you watch the press conference yesterday, you could see Jim Bridenstine being very kind of the diplomatic. We need to do better. We need to do better. There's another agency, you know, that's in, you know, there's a department that is in charge of that out there, and that would be the Coast Guard. And so I don't know. I don't think anybody expected quite this sort of reaction, but it's sort of like, I don't know. I don't want to point any fingers and stuff, but the job of stopping people, and there's also, it's international waters, so that it's a quasi kind of, hey, I can do whatever I want, but there is leeway to say, hey, this is a danger zone, there's this, whatever, and Coast Guard can board anybody with an American flag out in there, whatever. So we're probably going to see a lot more Coast Guard ships out there next time.
Well, if yes. It's international waters, then that becomes problematic, because you could militarize it and actually send out the Navy, but then you turn it into, it has the stink of a military operation on it, which I'm sure NASA, all things considered, would like to avoid.
I think this is a Coast Guard thing. It's like, you're just making sure that you ID the boats that are out there, and they know that they need to stay in a certain area. And then, you know, you can really punish people. Like, ultimately, like, those guys aren't in cigarette boats that are going to take off to Cuba or whatever. Right. Yeah. Like, they're just like weekend warriors that you can really put a hurting on
them. Again, you know, again, like we said, out there, international waters, it's not as clear as you can't go here. But if they got an American flag, the Coast Guard can. So there is that kind of like, yeah, you can't really say you got to get out of here, but they can also say, hey, leave or you'll be boarded, you know, you know, we'll get into that. But this is a problem that, you know, we haven't done a splashdown in 40 some years. You know, it is just, it's
holy cow. I didn't think about that, because we had the space shuttle, which landed on land, and then we were using the Soyuz, which just, you know, just kind of soft, hard crash landed on land. Wow.
I mean, we do splashdowns with, I mean, we've done with uncrewed. We've done, like, you know, the Dragons have done that. And then we've had, you know, The first stages have done that. But yeah, as far as a crew, like, yeah. And so that's, you know, very interesting.
Well, and, you know, keep in mind, of course, we've talked about this before, but it may feel like a step into the past to go back to splashdown technology. It's a proven way to safely land a capsule. And until we have as high of confidence of being able to launch into space through, you know, the SpaceX program, then we could start trying to land it, you know, Buck Rogers style. But it'll be a while. We're going to be in splashdown for a bit of testing.
But by the way, I just did some quick Googling on trends in boat ownership over the past several decades, and we are indeed at a, pardon the pun, high water mark for boats, including the number one state for recreational boating activity, measuring $23.3 billion of economic activity in 2018, the state of Florida.
Man, well, that's pre-COVID, man. If in a world where sometimes you just want, like my neighbors across the street just bought a boat, and I'm certain, because there's just, you know, you get the cabin fever, and it's like, wouldn't it be great to just go and
make sure that your social bubble is indeed the only bubble the ocean. You are.
And for people who aren't familiar with, like, Florida, like, I lived in the town of Plantation, which Justin and I both went to school there. We were 8 miles, 4 miles inland, 4 or 5 miles inland, I would say. We had a canal in our backyard that had ocean access. So we would, from our backyard, we could hop on a boat, and there were thousands of canals like that in Florida. So it's not just like, and so you didn't have to go drive your boat, you know, to a jetty. You just went to your backyard, got your boat, drove down the canals for a few miles and stuff, and you're out in the ocean. And that's Florida. It's kind of makes it awesome and scary. And you can read more about that in my book, The Girl Beneath the Sea, which is set in Florida and boating culture.
I
think that. Yeah, it is one of those things. I think it was hard for them to imagine that this many people would sort of show up, or people would be that stupid and get close. But hey, people.
I mean, okay, look. Looks over left shoulder, looks over right shoulder. You tell me the three of us happen to be on a boat, and then we get the news, we get the coordinates. You tell me we're not going to take a little 10-mile journey. Take a little peeksy-loo.
I mean, I would stay outside the zone where the Coast Guard had said please stay out of.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think 100% we are going as close as we feel like we want to get eyes on it, and I don't know if we would venture much further beyond that. But as long as we could see something falling out of the sky,
I don't know,
we would
guys.
Be happy.
The GPS is working, but I don't have internet. So I'm trying to look up what the safe distance is that they want us to stay. I mean, let's just, you know, kind of stay what feels right far away.
Yeah. So lost in all this, though, is the fact that, hey, holy crap, a private company was able to take astronauts to the National Space Station and return them back to Earth safely. And wasn't really a competition, but certainly was a there was a bit of a race between SpaceX and Boeing. Boeing has the Starliner program. And when this was first announced, it got a lot of attention because that Boeing was able to get the contract for $4.2 billion. SpaceX got it for $2.6 billion, which one of those numbers is a lot bigger than the other one. Boeing was made, you know, almost nearly $2 billion more to go to build the Starliner.
The Boeing is like the tiny space shuttle one, right?
That's the Sierra Nevada.
Okay.
The Boeing is a Starliner. It's another large capsule looking thing.
Got it. Okay.
And that was the one that they had a couple problems initially. Both Boeing and SpaceX were going through a lot of parachute development issues, trying to make them work. You know, Boeing did one of the tests where one of the parachutes didn't deploy or the parachutes weren't attached. Like, oh, that's just a minor problem. Like, kind of a big problem. They were trying to do their last test mission was unmanned. It was supposed to go up and intercept on a doing an intercept course with the International Space Station. But there was a software malfunction. So they avoided doing that and they were able to re-enter it and bring it back. And they found out there was another software problem that could have been catastrophic had there been crew on board. And Boeing was like, hey, we can put a patch for that. And NASA's like, you know, and they publicly said, NASA said, you know, we spent a lot of attention on SpaceX because their pathway is unconventional to us. It's different than what we're doing. And then you have to read through the lines. Like, we probably should have spent some more time working with Boeing.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So it may be that Boeing was the less fun child to play with and got less correction.
It's Boeing. They're fine. You know, Boeing is fine. Boeing is fine. It was that kind of mentality. SpaceX, and again, you listen to the relationship between NASA talks about SpaceX, and it is extremely complimentary. NASA has an incredible amount of experience and knowledge, et cetera, from, you know, being, you know, just, you know, pioneers in this, you know, as far as, you know, building different kinds of craft, et cetera, and what to do. A young company like SpaceX, which is willing to say, hey, we're going to innovate fast, move quickly. You work with a company, you work with organizations like NASA. It is great. I think it's a great sort of thing where you have people say, hey, we'll build a thing, we'll make it work. If it doesn't, we're going to talk to you and you're going to help us understand why. Boeing is sort of like, well, we know what we're doing, but also like, we hear Boeing, but it's like, you know, it's a label. It's a label now. And does it mean,
you know, it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that it's the height of the kind of innovation that has made Boeing the company that it is. It also is like these defense contractors that are literally the military industrial complex. You hire them because you don't want to deal with them a lot, right? Like you just say, give us the thing. Like, that's the point of a Boeing. That's the point of a Northrop Grumman. That's the point of a Lockheed Martin.
Right. And if you have a conversation, the conversation is always, how's it going? Answer, great. Do you need more money? And they say either not yet or yes, a lot. And that's the conversation. And then you have space.
And then you get a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have a reliable partner that delivers you these things. And it's like, we're just at a point now where, you know, none of these, all these companies, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman and Boeing and some of the other ones, like, they don't move all that fast. And they often subcontract with each other because they understand that there is a certain speed to this. And SpaceX is a company that's moving lightning fast compared to where some of these, I mean, at least where the pace of space contracting was before.
And I think it's fair to say that there are alternate timelines. I mean, there are alternate companies that are taking unconventional approaches that are folding and troubled and having to be sold and resold. What was Paul Allen's company again that just got bought?
Like Straddle Launch, but got acquired.
SpaceX appears to have picked the right strategy and is moving in the right direction, and thankfully is doing very, very well, and we're all better off for it. But for every SpaceX, there's a Virgin Galactic that's having difficulties, or a Blue Origin that isn't moving as fast as it would like, or a Straddle Launch that is troubled.
Yeah, I think that I would say that part of what's helped SpaceX is that one is the integration of outside methods. Like somebody's pointed out, there are a lot of great people from SpaceX came from other people. They brought Lou Gerstenmaier from NASA, now works for SpaceX, and they bring in some industry people, great. But then they take, you have Elon Musk, who also runs Tesla. And so he's understood, mass manufacturing. And so you get that where you get some of these divisions with these aerospace corporations, they're like, we know how to build one, but like it's just important. We're going to contract this out to some company, across the country, and it'll take 8 months to get it. SpaceX tries to do a lot as much as they can in-house, which like Tesla did, and Tesla got criticized for it, but they're like, we want to control our supply chain. Some things you can't do that for, but a SpaceX rocket is SpaceX makes the engine. SpaceX makes so much of the stuff. Like when we went to the factory, we saw all the things we're able to do in-house, and also the fact that we saw the guys with the wrenches working on the rocket engines, and then there's the tower with the offices and the engineers who designed them. And so if the guy on here is like, oh, can I use, hey, these bolts, is it okay if we use this different length bolt? They just go call the guy and he comes down on the floor.
And that's also, they were at the sweet spot of 3D printing technology. So they were able to create, fabricated parts right there on the facility. I mean, part of it is a function of embracing, emerging technologies at just the right time that worked out well for them.
Yeah, I just think that flat sort of structure. I mean, because you think about like if you go to Cape Canaveral, and you go walk through the different sort of like, oh, this is this company does their assembly here. They do this here. They ship this from Georgia over here. And then Alabama makes this part. And then this comes from here. And then you realize like just moving the stuff back and forth. And the fact that the guy building this and the guy with the blueprints who designed it are in different time zones. And, how that affects stuff to get made.
Yeah.
Well, here's something that can affect this podcast, and that is patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where you, the fine folks of the internet, are making sure that we show up here each and every Monday to talk about the fantastic, talk about the realistic, and talk about the borderlands between the two here on the Weird Things podcast. Get on the train and you get the custom RSS feed. Gets you things just a touch faster than they would otherwise. It is patreon.com/weirdthings, and we thank you for your patronage.
Ah, gentlemen, it's that time of year. Can you feel it in the air? Can you feel what it is?
Face meltingly hot in Texas. Is that what you're asking? The beginning of 100 days of 100 degrees plus in Austin? Is that the time of year?
No, let's talk more about Mars. Let's talk about Mars not being so Texas-centric, Brian.
I mean, there are days that I think that it's hot enough that I'm just like, God, just 3 seconds on Mars. Just flash me there and then flash me back. I think I'll be good.
So we've noticed that there's a pattern of Martian. Mars has seasons too. And we've been noticing now that there is, around this time part of the Martian year, very elongated cloud forms. They get this very long cloud. If you go look at this cloud on Mars, you can see this cloud that is like 1,000 miles long.
Is that Olympus Mons? Is that like a...
No. No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
No.
So it's not like based on a geographic feature or... It's
well, no, it would be, it appears to be like coming from a crater or some aspect with it. So it probably is, a bunch of vapor or something coming from probably, you know, underground ice, etc.
So we should hashtag we get at Mars, you vape. Like, it's just blowing massive clouds.
Yeah. But it's, you know, one of these very interesting features of it, because we think of Mars being a very static planet. We think of Mars as just sort of like, it's just this dead planet. Geologically speaking, we're not quite sure yet if there's, you know, much going on as far as like, you know, any kind of volcanic activity. But we see things like this where when the weather changes a little bit, we can tell that there are things happening too. Ice stuff, et cetera, underground, or CO2, there's dry ice there, et cetera, like the polar caps, et cetera. That's anything too, is watching those shrink and expand.
We might have talked about this before, but before he passed, Carl Sagan proposed that one of the Mars probes, they should spend the extra, you know, mass and weight, you know, very, very precious and expensive, to put a microphone on there so that we could just listen to the wind blowing on Mars. We could actually hear what it, you know, because, you know, he was obviously very big into the poetry and, you know, making space accessible and real to quote unquote normal humans. But I always thought that was a haunting and wonderful idea, and I hope somebody does it.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what's on the payload package as we, what just launched, by the way. We were worried about the, again, another big space week. Mars Perseverance, the Mars 2020 mission, you know, with the Mars 2020 rover, et cetera, that launched. We were worried about that making the window, and it took off, and that's heading to Mars, and that's got a lot of, that's going to have the Perseverance rover. It's going to have the Ingenuity helicopter, which we're all going, helicopters on Mars? That's crazy. Mean,
we already have SUVs on Mars. Why not? You know, it's like, let's put a Navy on Mars while we're at it.
Well, that's we've talked about that before. Like the Perseverance weighs 1,000 kilograms. Okay, this is a big beast, and I'm looking through, and it's got a ton of different probes on there. So I'm looking through to see. I wonder if the microphone might be interesting. I know they're going to have a lot of cool sound stuff.
Well, but and I think nowadays also the sensitivity of the instruments are probably enough that they could manufacture what the sounds of Mars sound like, you know, but this is, you know, what, 30, 40 years ago, he's saying, put a microphone on there so we can hear. and it's like, I don't know that that's in the budget. He's like, wait, guys, no, but it, just imagine everyone's all like, listen to Mars.
You know, there's a precedent for that. I'm trying to find the item on that. There was one of the people who directed was working on Hubble, Bob Williams, and he said, hey, let's aim Hubble at a dark part of the sky where there's nothing there.
Oh,
and that, people are like, that's sort of like
that's the deep field image, right?
Just jump to the story. It's fine, bro.
I'm sorry. I got excited because I'm very excited.
All right. This was, they're like, it's a dumb idea. Why'd you do that? There's nothing. It's dark. Why would you aim the telescope at a dark spot in the sky? And they were right, and they never did it. Move on to the next story. Brian, tell them what happened.
Of course they did it. They're like, well, do your dumb idea. We'll point at a black, dumb, nothing there part of the sky. And instead, what they get is one of the most spectacular images that Hubble ever produced, the Hubble deep field image, where a totally perceived as black, dark part of the sky is filled with a seemingly uncountable number of not stars, but freaking galaxies of stars. Reinforcing just how incredible and incomprehensible the universe is.
Yeah. I don't know if this one led to the deep field, but this was another example of just how incredible what it is. You leave that, you know, leave the electronic shutter open for 100 hours, and you know, it's just, it's like, you think like Leland Hook, you know, this drop of water. I'm going to test my microscope out on this because clearly it'll be pure. Ah, what are these things floating around in there?
Oh,
you know?
Dude, that was my favorite part of life science was, he called them wee beasties. Is that what he called them?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
And he was looking at, look at all the other things he looked at under the microscope, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, geez. So, yeah, Leeuwenhoek just took a drop of clear water and peeked in and was blown away seeing, you know, what we now understand as microscopic life. And he basically looks down and sees a freaking zoo. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. Kind of terrifying. You just look at your glass of probably brown water back then and like, oh, God. Start not drinking anything. And still took a long time for germ theory to come into play. And still today, we still,
yeah.
Oh, I want a hug.
we the family just two nights ago finished The Good Place. And one of the last episodes, they meet a character who died a very long time ago and was good. And they're like, why are you in The Good Place? And he says, he's like, I help the poor. He's like, what did you die of? I got a cut. In my time, you got a cut and you died. If you drank water that wasn't warm enough, you died. Man, I would have loved to have a vaccine. And you guys seem to hate them. Like, yeah.
I want to do one more story here. Something we talked about a while ago. We remember the demo that Adobe did of the ability to copy voices and to have like to make edit voices. And we've talked about some other technologies come a long ways where you can cut up and mix voices and stuff. Did we cover recently one of the latest developments with like that? Like now everybody's doing this. Like there's a bunch of startups doing different kind of technology and letting you clone your own voice and edit it. And there's an online demo somebody put up that shows you that like what one coder can do. If you go to vo.codes, this person took samples of people like David Attenborough, Gilbert Gottfried, Sam Altman, Craig Ferguson. Is his high quality ones, and he's got a bunch of other ones. And so you just enter, and the more text you enter, the better. If you go in there and go to a high quality one first, and then give them something big, you know, give them something interesting to say. And just to show you, there's a lot of you can the ways to do this. There's like models like Tacotron, which you know, I think Google developed that. These other sorts of models that allow you to be able to create. You know, the synthesized voices, and people are continuously finding ways to improve them, make them better. And so now, you know, we're in a very interesting point where, you know,
they
independent developers.
Haunted.
Okay, so we've got David Attenborough here, if you guys want to hear him speak. Here we go.
So it's going to go there.
Can you
the
believe
text,
this freaking frog is amazing? I'm David, and I am David Attenborough.
can we find out what Gilbert Gottfried thinks of the Weird Things podcast?
Oh, absolutely.
In the meantime, what this made me think of the moment, I was unfamiliar with the story, but the moment you said it, the moment you know something is possible, all of a sudden, everybody can do it. And somehow, even though they, you know, Adobe never, as far as I know, they're reserving that technology for high-end projects and super expensive behind-the-scenes stuff. You got to work with them. Like, but by publicly releasing that demo, the world now knows that it's possible. So, of course, a billion people are going to.
I mean, in this case, it was more there had already been published research on how to do this. And like I said, there's a model out there called Tacotron and versions of it that you can find on GitHub. And it's people going and saying, you know, researchers published something 2 years ago and people did it. And a year later, there's a better model. And so everybody goes and downloads this and plays with this and sort of does it. And it was Adobe was one of many people kind of working in this area and they didn't publish their stuff. But this is based on stuff that's kind of Tacotron 1 or 3 or versions. I don't know if it's based on Taco, but I'm saying there's all these the weird thing about AI and ML stuff is like you could OpenAI has GPT-2, which got published, and you could now play with that version. If you had the instances and were able to run it, you could be able to do that. And so, and then if you wanted to change it and tweak it, and then you could, you know, change things or whatever. So that's part of the big thing there. It's more like just go to GitHub, download it, now make your own version.
We did just get an iTunes review here from Gilbert Gottfried.
Oh, sweet.
We're requesting it and calculating it and toodly-doodling it.
He's Skyping in right now.
I freaking love the Weird Things podcast.
It gets me my weekly dose of space expanders and yes, Snake's space elevator. I'm Gilbert Gottfried.
That's the highest quality one. Okay.
So the highest quality one uses the Justin Robert Young trick of always ending an impression by announcing who you are.
That science over here is tagging that on the end.
They should be able to say their own name, I would think.
They should, yeah.
This is pretty cool. Still, I feel like it definitely has some ways to go with some of the speech, but that's cool, man. And there's a lot of voices. I wonder if this is similar to, there was a YouTube channel that I think we talked about on the show a little while ago, that has the president's reading raps, and stuff like that. Because I see that they've got various presidents in here too.
Well, didn't they wound up banning the channel? Wasn't that the news story? Was that there was
a video got taken down, but I don't know that the channel was removed.
No, I mean, look, we have miles to go on where we are ethically and where we are from a terms of service perspective on these kinds of deep fake things. Because I can see very quickly if you are Craig Ferguson or David Attenborough or Gilbert Gottfried, the things that you could, as this technology gets better, the things that you can have them say is something that I would imagine if it was my voice, I'd be I want some kind of control on this, depending on the platform it's getting published on.
Well, and so, and we've talked a bit about it before, but it's like, man, how do you handle the fingerprinting on a video event, a news event, a press release? I mean,
so Adobe actually announced today, by the way, which it was funny because the story was in the hopper for that, was Adobe's announced a new initiative, which is for photographs and stuff, and is a way to sort of fingerprint stuff at this sort of the file level. And the idea that would be that when you get the photo, there would be some sort of way to know. And that might be the sort of thing in the future when you get a photo or video or whatever, is that when you're encoding the stream or whatever, you use sort of a thing to sort of an authenticity key or something.
Yeah. And I guess we have a little bit of that. Not exactly fingerprinting, but you know, every time you take a photo, it geotags it and it says what kind of camera was used and all this stuff, the metadata, but of course that could be faked or whatever. That'll be interesting.
I think, we've talked about this before about it's, you know, the argument we had Photoshop and it's that, you know, we were fine. It's but Photoshop didn't have a million bots trying to create photos of your mother to confuse you or deceive you, or artificial videos, you know, people getting a random Skype call and I pick it up oh, Justin, how you doing?
Oh, speaking
I am fine. I need
Skype
your bank
calls.
Account.
We just got a new iTunes review for the Weird Things podcast. So I just want to make sure we all get a chance to hear it and listen to it.
I'm Betty White and I love listening to the Weird Things boys, Andrew, Justin, and Brian, every week on the Things podcast, 5 stars, and I'm Betty White.
A little sandwich. So, you announce it up front and at the end. That's good.
And so
she's got an accent on that one a little bit. She misspelled weird one of those times.
The background on how this gets better is the way this works right now is they take a ton of samples of somebody's voice with transcripts of what those words are. And then for the audio, you'll see this waveform. And I don't know for this, but sometimes that waveform, you see that image, it's actually using that image to encode and decode the voice. It's basically using image generation to do it. And so you're compressing the heck out of it a lot. And then when you're creating that one, you're taking this sort of very compressed version of the voice and reconstructing it, and you get a lot of loss. But if you just said, I'm going to put 10 times more resources into creating this voice, it will get better. It will get better.
Absolutely.
More has to do with the sampling size.
Yeah, you're not going to take the resources of the NSA and put it behind a demo website like this.
No, no, exactly. And that's just a lot of image recognition algorithms we've mentioned before. They'll take a big image and compress it down and try to recognize it from that, which you lose a lot of detail. And that's when we get into some of the, you know, some of the other issues, the problems of facial recognition, is you just start increasing that sample size. It's going to get spookier and spookier and spookier until, you know, and I've seen there's demos. I don't know if we showed one before that could just listen to 3 seconds of your voice and emulate it.
Well, and man, it's going to be a legitimate problem in 10, and of course I say 10, so that means cut it in half, 5. Like, there'll be entire chunks of civilization that are, that truly believe that a person doesn't exist, or that, you know, entire events never happened, and they'll have, you know, credible reason to say and think so.
And like, this technology is becoming very available. There's a podcast editing app on the Mac called Descript.
Yes.
And they have a similar feature where you can just type into it and it will generate audio based on the audio that you fed it to, like, cover up parts of your script. It's
Doesn't that also give you the ability to, like 10 years ago, if you wanted to, let's say there's a misstep or a curse or whatever, it's hard to know where they are. If you didn't mark it, you're hosed. But is this the same software that transcripts it so that you can
there
say,
are
like,
a lot of those out
where's
there
the
now.
Part where so-and-so cursed?
Yeah, Descript is one of many softwares out there where you feed it audio and it creates a transcript. And based on how you do it, it can do it on speakers and stuff. Speaking of speakers, we did just get another iTunes review, and I do want to make sure.
I just
want to make sure that we read and support the community.
Yeah.
By saying,
yeah.
Anyway. Listen up, Comic Simonson. I love this podcast, the Weird Things podcast. I can't get enough of spiders and goblins. Simmons.
Oh, it really
doesn't. No, it doesn't like JK.
If it doesn't know how to say it, it won't. It just won't say it at all. So Chuck Luckers and gee dang it didn't quite make it in. Thank you, JK Simmons. 5 stars.
Not my tempo.
That's right.
Yeah, we all remember the days when we could tell the difference. Enjoy it now, you know. gentlemen, picks.
I watched a movie this morning with the whole family, and I loved it. It's Battlestar Galactica, set in World War II. The joke I'm making, of course, is that Battlestar Galactica is apparently based on the structure of a destroyer and protecting a fleet. I'm talking about the movie Greyhound. That's a Apple Plus original, which if you listen to interviews, according to Bryce. I don't know who said it, but somebody said, if you listen to Tom Hanks, maybe it was Justin that said it. It sounds like Tom Hanks really wanted this to make it to the movie theaters. And
that was, we reported on that in Court Killers. It was a story on Court Killers.
But you can see why, man. This belongs in a movie theater. It's great. It uses, if you've ever seen Battlestar Galactica and loved it, you will instantly recognize that everything about Battlestar Galactica, the structure, the function of the ship, the job of protecting the fleet, the command hierarchy, everything from the captain of the XO on down to marking bearings, to making contact, all of that is there. It's like, it is electric, and I absolutely loved it. And
I watched it as well because we've got it on spoiler time this week. It was great. And I think one of the things that it really has going for it is that it's only 90 minutes. Like, I think if it were, you probably could find another 20 minutes of story. Cause like, Tom Hanks's character kind of has one note, and it's, I got to get back to my girl. Which is fine for a 90 minute film. And it's a lot of like giving out orders and all that stuff. But also you get into the vernacular and all really quickly. So there's not a lot of over explanation of what these things that they're saying are. And also like, big spectacle moments. That moment at the end where the ship does the thing.
Yeah. No. You're right. Well, and what was really fun for me is because the kids really enjoyed Master and Commander. I was able to get them to watch, and I agree. I don't think I could have gotten Penny to watch it if it wasn't only 90 minutes long. Also, I don't know that I could have taken much more than 90 minutes of the intensity of this movie because it is electric and clinching.
I was looking something up. We're talking about the one where the ship is trying to outrun the bad guys and they're getting picked off one by one. That was like Battlestar Galactica.
Yes.
We already reviewed Last Jedi. Why are we talking about Last Jedi?
What was really
torpedo?
it actually took us nearly 2.5 hours to watch because the kids they were interested enough in the visualization of everything and I kept having a pause to explain what a countermeasure was, what a depth charge was, the difference between radar and sonar, and why this is happening, and well, why can't he just interrupt this guy? And you know, it's like, well, this is the way radios work or whatever. Also, throughout the entire thing, man, oh man, it's like when you get through the first battle, you're like, man, if I lived through something like that, I would be grandpa never failing to shut up about it. You know, if I, and it's like, oh, you see all the guns going off, and it's like, oh, that's why grandpa was deaf, you know? And it's like, oh, you lose somebody you love, and you're there for the funeral. No wonder grandpa wouldn't shut up about old Charlie or whatever. It's like, it makes it so real in such a powerful way. I loved it. I loved it a lot.
My grandfather was like the opposite, and he was a very quiet guy. You get him talking, whatever. And I didn't know until after he passed away, I read his biography. He wrote about his autobiography about when he served in the European theater. Then literally not making stuff up. He was like storming machine gun nests and grenading stuff.
Holy
and
I'm
like,
cow.
Holy crap. I'm like, what? And he had kept pushing to be in the frontline duty because he had to wear glasses. But once he reached a certain rank, he could assign himself to that. I'm like, oh my God. And I'm like, I know why he doesn't talk about this. It's like,
Jesus.
Like, holy crap. It was, I was like, just reading the sort of accounts and stuff. I'm like, oh yeah, the day that, you know, his CO, the second in charge, then the guy below him all got killed, but he wasn't there because he had gotten a day pass because he wrote an essay and then came. I'm like, holy crap. Like, you know, just the quiet guy smoking a cigar, you know, walking my grandmother's Alasa Opso, you know, out at night in New Mexico. I'm like, I get it now.
It's great and wastes no time. And it's really novel because they replaced the Cylons with Germans, which I never would have thought to do. And
interesting take.
And it's a ragtag fleet of many different nations that are, you know, there's a Greek vessel and an English vessel and the 13th. They do that instead of the 13 colonies. 12 colonies.
Did it get sued?
actually, it makes me I want to go back and trace what books, like whether or not this, because this movie was based on a specific book from the 1950s, and it makes me want to know whether or not Ronald D. Moore mentions that specific book in you know, his formation of Battlestar.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked it a lot.
Yeah. I finished the most recent episodes of The Expanse. So I'm caught up on The Expanse. By and large, really, really liked it. I thought that this most recent season, boy, you can tell the difference in quality when all of a sudden the richest man on the planet loves your show and you are exclusive on his platform because, boy, those location shots look a lot better. The action, like, it goes from a show that has, like, science fiction action. So it's a lot of, like... We don't really have, we got a stunt coordinator, but mostly this is going to be people staring at each other with guns and maybe pushing each other to, like, by the finale of the most recent season, it's a full one unbroken shot. Like Jason Bourne level amazing action stuff. So I enjoyed it quite a bit, really an achievement. And I was happy to hear that they were done shooting the next season before all the pandemic hit. So hopefully we'll get that sooner rather than later.
Nice. I got a pick. I heard about this the other day. I think it was yesterday, and I couldn't do anything about it because it takes Sundays off. It is my new favorite obsession. It's a little thing called Blaseball. So this is a simulated baseball league where there are all sorts of wacky rules and there's betting. So every week is a season. Monday through Friday is a season of simulated baseball. In fact, they're just finishing up day three of the season for today for the hour. So Monday through Friday is a season. Every hour is a day and a game. They have like 16 teams that are all playing, and it's super cool. Like, it's simulated baseball, but there's There's a like
a big upset between the breath mints and the firefighters.
I didn't know. Right, I didn't know that these were real things. I saw you tweeted out all these logos that some of them I love. The Charleston Shoe Thieves was exceptional.
So my team, my personal team is the Hawaii Fridays. It's Island Time. And we've just been getting our butts handed to us by the San Francisco Lovers all day. And I don't think that'll change because so the Lovers were worst in their division last season. And so now they have they were elected to be given four strikes. And so whenever they are up to bat, they get four strikes instead of three.
Oh, my God. That would be an amazing adjustment to the game.
It's an incredible sort of advantage.
The Wild Wings versus the Spies.
The Mexico Wild Witties versus the Houston Spies. That's right. The Dallas Stakes are on here. Yeah, the Dallas Stakes. So you kind of got fun, wacky team names. But the other part of this, so you can look at the thing while it's happening and just play along and bet. But also the other part of it is they have a Discord server. And so they have like a live watch channel, and then each team has their own channels, and everyone kind of, you figure out what everyone's kind of, attitude is. So like on the Fridays one, it's just like, hey man, whatever. We're just having fun out there. We're just playing the game for the fun of it. And then you like watch the live watch party channel where it's like super fast, and you because everyone, all the games happen at the same time, so you'll just see we are from Chicago on the chat, and then like a few minutes later you'll see go back to Chicago.
This is amazing.
It's really fun. It's free. It was really easy to sign up for. They have like Apple, like the Apple sign-in thing that you can do like other normal sign-in stuff too, but it was really easy to just be like boop and then I have it. You just pick a favorite team, but you can bet and they give you free coins. And yeah, at the end of every week they do they hold elections to give benefits to different players, to different teams and stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I think this is really cool, and I'm really digging it. Blazeball.com.
That's awesome.
Andrew?
My pick is, if you want more World War II stuff, hey, you know what's better than World War II?
World War III?
Literally everything. It was a horrible event. Okay. Anything is better. Okay. Okay. But the next, the .0001 thing that's better, World War II in color. Have you ever watched this documentary series?
I've seen little bits of footage here and there, and you're not talking about the
not
World
the
War
Peter
One,
Jackson
yeah, not
one.
That one that was colorized,
no.
But
no,
this
they
is,
shall not grow old. No, that's
yeah. This is actual footage that was shot in color in the very early days of color film, right?
No, this was black and white footage that may have been originally color, then converted to black and white, and done a really crappy conversion process to color. But as a documentary, it's really good. The color process is an old, they used, it looks like Bad Turner sort of version of this. But forgetting that, the amount of documentary footage they have is incredible. And so basically it is, goes through, you know, the post-World War I, what's the situation in Europe and America, the rise of Hitler, rise and fall and rise, et cetera, what's going on in the world, just a really good global look at what was going on. From and in the Pacific theater, you know, Japan's invasion of Manchuria, all the things that go before. I cannot recommend it enough because it's one of these things where the further away we get from it, the more condensed the story gets and the more details get left out. And this is a 13 episode series that's got just a really, really good just sort of explanation of like what was going on the different fronts. When was Germany friends with Russia? When were the enemies? You know, what happened there? What was the state of individual economies going on between places and stuff? Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of, I would say, you know, their delineations between what made fascism and socialism, communism, I'd say is probably a little bit from a different school of thought than maybe I would subscribe to. But that's really not as important as, you know, they presented these opposite ends of the extreme where they're more both on the authoritarian end, but that's sort of irrelevant when it comes to just the battles and what happened, you know, in each place.
Wow, that's cool.
It's on Netflix. Yeah. Just I'm like, man, there's so much I forgot in high school. There's so many details I didn't realize. And then, like, you know, why was Guadalcanal important? You know, we know it was a big battle. What was the big deal about Guadalcanal? You know, there's the movie Midway. Why do we care about Midway? Why was that a big deal? And then you look in the context of this, you're like, oh, I get why this was a big deal, you know? And the events of the movie Greyhound, you know, you understand the context of where that came into play and why that was such a big deal.
Yeah, they did a they did a good job of sort of, you know, setting that up.
Cool. So that's my pick. Nice. World War II.
It also looks like they might have these on YouTube, just if someone doesn't have Netflix. World War II in HD color, what might be what you want to look for in that. That's cool.
Yeah. Looks like it's spelled British style too.
Kalur.
Yeah.
But that's just a side note too. There have been people taking like really, really old film footage and then using some of the up-resing techniques and the newer colorization techniques and putting that on YouTube. And like, if you type in like, you know, old footage of Beijing or other places like London, like 1960s, it's captivating because it's just kind of random sort of documentary sort of footage, just people hanging out and doing stuff. And like, London looks like straight out of the set of Austin Powers. It really looks like that. And then, you know, the best part, the London one, is it looks so weird. And then you see somebody wearing a Dylan t-shirt. It just feels, you know, normal.
Wait, was it on Weird Things that we talked about the train pulls into station up-resing? Yeah, with the colorization and all that. Oh, that was astonishing.
But hey, go back to what Bryce just showed there. But look at that. That would be, would that be Beijing? Or is that, what were we looking
Beijing
at there?
Beijing around 1920.
Okay, look at this. And it's like, it's, you know, you've got the traditionally dressed people with, you know, the ponytails, the hats, you know, the caps, all the sort of stuff, you know, the guy carrying like right out of a movie kind of thing. And, you know, you talk about a rapid development of an economy. If you go look at, let's say, Tokyo 1920, you're going to see people in bowler hats and business suits, et cetera.
Wow.
Which sort of sets up why was Japan able to go invade and take over such large parts of China, being even though a smaller country, was just a modernization. So it's insane. So just a fun thing to go look at if you want to check that out. So just look up like old footage, like really old, and be surprised what you can find. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.